Hello and welcome to episode 6 of series 4 of the Poolside Pass podcast. On today's episode, I'm joined by Robin Armayan, who is the director of coaching and director of swimming at Plymouth Leander. Over the years, Robin has coached national medalists, international swimmers, and this year he has put Laura Stevens on the GB team, as well as swimmers onto European junior teams, as well as other countries' national teams as well. It really excited to get into the conversation with Robin about his coaching journey and his philosophies behind coaching and how he develops as a coach. But before we get into the interview with Robin, just want to say a huge thank you to all the listeners who tuned in to episodes 1 to 5. If you've not listened to those, make sure you go check them out. We've got Kevin Pickard, Rick Hall, Andy Manley, Russ Barber, Sean Barmer. We've got plenty of fantastic coaches on those episodes, so make sure you go check them out. Also, we're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Poolside Pass. Don't forget our website, www.thepoolsidepass.com. Okay, so I think it's about time I introduced Robin to the podcast. Robin Armayan, how are you getting on?
Going very well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good. So it's great to get you on the show. Why don't we start by just getting a little bit of your background within swimming and how you got into coaching?
Yeah. So I swam in a club in the southwest of France in the suburb of Bordeaux for about 15 years. And I progressed from, you know, age group, county level to youth. And started my coaching career. There was nothing amazing, by the way, about my swimming career. I was just a very, very average swimmer. More interested in, you know, making friends. I worked really hard in the pool. I enjoyed the training, not so much the competition. And then after a few years after uni, I decided to start coaching. I was still training a little bit. The two were clashing, so I stopped swimming and concentrated on coaching full time. My first job was 3 hours a week, age groupers. So that was interesting. and then I progressed to something a little bit more substantial with being in charge of the age group program and helping the head coach with youth swimmers at regional and national level.
Cool. So you say you started out age group coaching. What were some of the key lessons that you learned then when you first started out with those age group swimmers?
Quite a few of them, to be honest with you. Quite frankly, I see many, many coaches who bypass this step. I think it's a very important part of someone's career, I think. And if possible, I would even start with learn to swim. I think it's extremely important for a coach to have the full package. I think the biggest lesson for me would be taking the time to develop the swimmer at a young age. And by that, I mean clearly identifying what areas are very important. So what are the best swimmers in the world doing? Okay, and how can that relate to young age group swimmers? So for example, the best swimmers in the world in 203 will have a 6-foot kick throughout the entire race. Okay, so how can I teach an age grouper to maintain a constant 6-foot kick in training? And then how does that transfer into a racing situation? So, you know, starting from what we can observe at a high level and then sort of backtracking all the way down to the little ones. I think it's important to be inspiring. I think it's, you know, you've got to, the kids go join a swimming club to make friends and potentially because they like swimming, but I think primarily to have friends. And so being inspiring, having encouraging a team spirit. I know it's an individual sport, but I think they need each other to progress. And I think encouraging that is very important. Taking the time to develop them, not rushing into things. it's a long, long way to fulfill their potential. So, you know, being patient, taking your time, and clearly knowing what's important. I think that's key. Technique, kicking, body position, and the physiological components of, you know, their weekly program is important. But I think such things are key as well. So, yeah, the biggest lesson that I would definitely say that, really, being patient. Being patient, being inspiring. It's highly rewarding as well. And I think if you understand and you can develop a good aerobe swimmer, I should say swimmer, not just one, not just the best one that comes up and is amazing. But being a good aerobe coach across genders, abilities, is important. And then after that, you take the next step potentially to youth swimmers. And that's one thing I explain quite often to aerobe coaches. Whether they're employed by us or they come and ask a few questions, I'll say, before you want to move on to, you know, youth coaching, can you get your swimmers to qualify at county level across a wide range of events with great skills and great technique? And then we'll see.
Great. So when you were starting out as an age group coach, did you have a mentor? Was there another coach you were working with that had a really big influence on how you worked?
Yeah, so the person who coached me, his name is Michel Bouvier. He was a 200 butterflyer national French record holder back in 1991, I think, something like that. And he coached me for many years and then took another job, but still in the same leisure center. And so after every coaching session, I would go and see him and spend 2-3 hours talking, or actually more listening, asking as many questions as I could and just listening. And it was a huge, huge influence on me. We're still in touch, which is great. He was by miles the biggest influence from a coaching perspective. And then after that, there was someone in Australia as well who helped me quite a lot.
Cool.
as well as a few coaches in the UK. One of them is Dave Heathcock. He's the head coach of Ealing. He was a fairly big influence for me in the sense that he was the head coach in my first Swim England selection. I think it was in 2011. He was in charge of the camp, and we had meetings every evening, and we would again spend hours talking and exchanging point of views, and it was great. So
it sounds like you've had, you know, good support all the way through your career, which is yeah. Great to hear about. You mentioned about your time in Australia. First of all, tell us, you know, what you were doing out in Australia. Yeah. And then second of all, you know, what were your big takeaways from that experience?
Yeah. So after a couple of years coaching in France, I felt a little bit stuck. The head coach was there to stay, you know, for a long time, and he's still there. So, and I just felt like I wanted to progress. I was probably a little bit impatient as well. And so talking to Michel, my mentor at the time, he said to me, you know, why don't you go to England? They've got good swimmers there. Or you could go to Australia. And I thought, England, food's not great, potentially. The weather's not great. I think Australia is more appealing. So I took a working holiday visa with two friends who were swimmers and coaches as well. And we all went together to Australia. And it was tough to start with because I couldn't speak a lot of English, especially with the Australian accent. I wanted that to be a big step in my life where I just wanted to see if I could fend for myself. So I basically paid for, I think, 2 weeks of accommodation. I took $300 with me and left my, you know, credit card or debit card at home and just went like that, with no English whatsoever, and $300. What I didn't see coming was how long it would take me to be comfortable with English, with the language. It took me a long time. So that was difficult, and I had to do 3 months of to renew your working holiday visa. I had to do 3 months in sugarcane planting and fruit picking and things like that. So, and we decided that we would do that as soon as we arrived. So then it's out of the way. So as well as doing that, I went to see the lady who had the swim school, and she took me sort of with her, and I would see the little ones, learn to swim program. And I just felt like I was in a completely different world. The way they were teaching, the exercises they were using, and also obviously the language, couldn't understand a word of it. But eventually, after a few months, things got better. And then I moved from there from Queensland. I went to Brisbane, and I spent some time observing Stephen Widmer. At the time, he had Libby Lenton, Liesl Jones, and a few other sprinters. So that was great. It wasn't a mentor as such. He just said, yeah, you can observe, no problem. But he didn't have much time for me, which was fine. I just could not speak English or understand it anyway. So I just, he gave me the sessions. I observed and learned from there. And then after that, I went to Melbourne. And I spent a lot of time with Brian Taylor, who's now in charge of the Australian swimming team. And that was great because my English was better. And he told me a lot. He took me under his wing for, I think, about 4 months, morning, afternoon, and he just told me everything he knew. At that time, my English was about 40% correct. <It's that. laughs> it was a great experience. What I learned from my trip in Australia was to structure my training sessions a lot more, to work a little bit more on my periodization. I think, to be honest with you, I don't think I got out as much as I could have simply because of the barrier, the language. It was so difficult that the first 9-10 months. I did the best I could at the time, but yeah. So yeah, it took a lot of work for me. But I also bought some DVDs. All the money I had, I would spend it on coaching things like DVDs, books, to learn the language and also to learn more about the job. That was great. Very, very tough experience, but it definitely had a big influence on my training program, in the sense that the way they see swimming fits my personality. I quite like hard work. I quite like, if I say volume, I'm going to be categorized as a big volume coach. I don't think it's true. I think it's smart volume. And I think their way of doing it fits in my personality quite well.
So you mentioned there just a couple of things I want to unpack a little bit more about that. First of all, you said, you really kind of at the start struggled with the language barrier, right? Were you in that situation where kind of still almost struggling with the language, but, trying to communicate with swimmers, trying to still deliver, parts of sessions? How did you kind of navigate your way through that period?
Yeah, it's a good question. It took a lot of hard work and effort. So, when I was planting sugar canes, I was with Australians, Irish, Scottish, English. I stayed away from French people, whether they were my friends or not, just because I wanted to speak English. I wanted to learn as quickly as possible. So at first, you just listen and you pick up one word out of 10, if you're lucky. And then they'll ask you always the same questions, where do you come from and what do you like? So you kind of repeat always the same sentences. It's a bit boring, but at the same time, it makes you a bit more comfortable and confident. And then just talking and listening to lots of different people, staying away from French people, reading books. I read loads of books. The first few books I read, I don't think I understood more than 10% of it. And I picked the wrong books as well. The lady said, yeah, it's easy to read, no problem. And it was all English, like, you know, back in the 17s or something. And so, it was tough. But, you know, listening to the music, trying to understand the lyrics. If we are watching movies, we had to watch that in English with English subtitles. So, you know, you spend 2 hours reading subtitles, don't pay attention to the movie. But, you know, you learn a lot quicker than, you know, being at school, I think, just because you're in a country, you have to. And that's how I did it, really, just picking things up.
Wow. I can't imagine going somewhere not understanding. Because, like, as, like, British people, we're generally terrible at languages. Like, we go somewhere and expect everyone just to speak our language to us, right? So I've got a lot of respect for people that just go to another country and have to learn language. Yeah. So that's quality. And then you mentioned when you was in Australia, like you said, you like hard work, and you know, you said you don't want to be categorized perhaps as, you know, one of those big volume coaches, but more kind of smart volume. What, let's talk a little bit about smart volume and what's the difference?
What I mean by that is, I saw something on the USA Swimming website a few years ago, and they put famous American coaches on the spectrum from very, very short training program, high intensity, so I guess USRPT, let's say, and then very high volume. And they put their photos on that spectrum according to where they thought they belong. And I thought, oh, I wonder where do I see myself in that spectrum? And I'm definitely more on the volume side, there's no doubt about it. But I think in a different way, you know, in Plymouth, we have swimmers who are very good at 50, 100. Some are very good at 100, 200. Some at 200, 400. I can't coach them all the same. They can't all do the same thing all the time. So, especially more in the early days where we definitely had a lot more swimmers where, you know, 50, 100, and senior swimmers as well. I think that's important to mention that they were senior swimmers. And so I think, you know, you have to adapt to the individual. But I do think that if you're a 200 plus, and even to some extent the 100, you need some volume. Just because that last 25 or the last 50 is not going to, you know, take care of itself just like that. And obviously, there will always be a few exceptions to that, a few talented swimmers who will not quite fit that, I guess, philosophy or that concept. But I'm okay with it. I think, you know, it depends on the individual. Who do you have in front of you? What's their background? Because I can't have someone with 12 hours of training per week for years and then move that swimmer up to 25 hours just like that. One, is it necessary? Two, how do we do that? So, yeah, it's very much for the individual. I'm just in a situation at the moment where I've got more mid-distance swimmers, really. Quite interestingly, we do have some very interesting sprint results, especially over the last, well, especially this season, I'd say, considering that we don't do that much sprinting. I think it's quite interesting.
Cool. So when you left Australia, your next move was to the UK, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you embarked on your first head coach position at Poole Swimming Club. How did your first head coach role kind of set you up to be, you know, an effective leader now in your role at Plymouth?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think first things first, I picked England because it was closer to France, to my family. And I really liked the Poole Swimming Club at the time, but they had loads of pool time. The swimmers were not necessarily the best, but they had loads of pool time, and I knew I could do something. Six years at Poole Swimming Club was a great experience as head coach because it's, at the time, it was a fairly small club in terms of members and quality of swimmers. And I kind of on poolside, I had to do sort of everything by myself. I had volunteers to help me, but I had no professional coaches to take some sessions, really. So I had a few volunteers who would run the Sunday session for me, which was great because that would give me a day off. But I had to run age group 3 miles, youth 3 miles, and one or two, you know, senior 3 miles. So, you know, and then from a behind the scene perspective, I had a committee, so, you know, parents, volunteers helping me run the club. I decided to change things right from the start, change the squad structure, the fees, everything. And again, that was a bit difficult because people don't like change. And, you know, it's fine. But it gave me a lot of experience to move on, but, you know, to help me be the person I am today. I think one thing I'd say is changing everything in a club when you arrive is, in my opinion, is still the best thing to do. You just got to try and get people on board. But also, you have to have results. Not necessarily in the short term, but in the medium term, you better have some good results. Otherwise, people are going to start questioning things a little bit. So, something to keep in mind.
So, you spent some time in Poole, and then you switched over to Plymouth, and then became kind of assistant head coach, deputy, and now you're head coach again. So taken kind of, I wouldn't like to say a step down, but in terms of responsibility, it's, you know, a lower level and then taking a step up. How did you kind of manage that, having lots of responsibility as a head coach and then down to kind of deputy and then back up to head coach, kind of going down and back up again? What was your experience like in that kind of transition?
Yeah, so I think in terms of responsibilities, it was definitely a step back, which, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing. You run a program that's quite small. I guess you make it medium. We had some reasonable results as well, good results. But then you become, you know, you become deputy or assistant head coach, and all of a sudden there's less paperwork to do, which is good. You know, I'm not going to lie. But also it was different because I had a few coaches, you know, below me, and my job was to help them as well. So I had that responsibility. When John was away, I had to sort of look after the performance guys a little bit more. But in terms of coaching, it was definitely a step forward because all of a sudden I could look after swimmers who are at European Youth Olympic level, European juniors. And also had, you know, the joy to coach senior swimmers as well. And so sometimes, you know, you got to take a step back in some areas to move forward. And for me, it was definitely the best thing to do. I think there's only so much you can do with passion and hard work. Poole was absolutely amazing, and I still keep an eye on their results. I absolutely love this club and the people involved in this club, more importantly. But I am quite ambitious, and I always ask myself, what's the next step? And I still do. What's the next step? What can I do better, different? And for me, having access to swimmers who are a bit older, at a higher level, that's where I saw myself, so I'm, you know, took that step, and I don't regret it. And then, yes, moving from assistant head to head coach, I did feel a little bit of pressure the first day, I think, and that's about it. Because after that, I was so busy, I did not have, you know, any time to think about anything else but trying to move things forward. So John had been there 27 years, obviously did a great job. But there was a lot of work to do in many different areas. So I had to get some volunteers to help me, and it was great because you don't want to be under too much pressure or put yourself under too much pressure, because to the point where it stops you from doing things right. So to me, being busy and you know, trying to restructure things a little bit and think about how we were going to finish that season, because I took over on the 1st of February. So we were getting close to the British champs in April, and then international commitments. So I had to sort of get in straight away. Fortunately, because I was assistant head before, the transition was a lot easier. I knew the swimmers, I knew what, you know, roughly what they were doing, where they were in the cycle, and I knew their weaknesses and their strengths. So I think it was a lot easier for me to pick it up this way. And also, if you concentrate on the swimmer and the human being, you just want to help them. You just want to support them. And then in a very short period of time, the swimmers realize that very quickly, that they do see your passion, they do see that you're committed, and you want to help. And then I think you create that bond between you and the athlete, and things work quite well, you know. And so the transition was fairly easy from that perspective, I think. I didn't think too much about the past results, and I just, you know, one step forward, keep going.
let's compare almost the role of the first head coach role you had to the head coach role you have now. What's kind of the differences in terms of kind of how you have to how you lead, I guess, right?
Yeah, true. There are many differences as far as the jobs are concerned, but also as far as the person is concerned, because the coach or the head coach I was between 2008 and 2014 and the person I am now are obviously, you know, quite different. I think in my early days at Poole, I was a little bit more of a, I guess, dictator. I wanted to change things, and I didn't leave, you know, too much room for people, parents, volunteers to say otherwise. I had a clear idea of where I wanted to go and how. I made it clear during my interview that I wanted to be free. To be honest with you, right, I'm not sure this is correct to say it, but I was paid £1,000 per month before tax. So I think they were they quickly realized I was working really hard, and I think that they trusted me, and they were quite happy, you know, I guess, to have me. That sounds a bit arrogant, I apologize for that, but for £1,000 a month. At the time, that was the one thing I was really...
Yeah.
The one thing I was totally unprepared for. I mean, at my interview, I went through their club record, their website, I knew everything. And then they asked me about the salary. And I was like, oh, I didn't even think about that. I didn't even know what a pound could buy me. Okay.
Yeah.
So when they say £1,000, I said, okay, sounds good. I don't know. So I think I don't see that as a bad thing. You know, it was easier for me because they knew that financially I was not necessarily getting the best deal. So I think that gave me a little bit of leverage with, you know, changing things quick and having it my way. So that was that. And then towards the end, I was probably a little bit more open, a bit more relaxed. Things were going fairly well for the club. So you can sort of back off a little bit. And then I think with Plymouth, it's very interesting because it was really difficult in a sense that I remember telling my mom, I don't know if I'm going to cope with all the administration. And she said, don't worry about the admin. Managing people will be your biggest challenge. She was a headmistress, so she kind of knew what was going to happen. And yeah, that was true. Managing people, so difficult. So difficult. We employ six coaches. Some are employed by Plymouth College. Some are employed by Plymouth Leander. So there's a very strong partnership between the two. We have support staff. We have the boarding staff from a college perspective, because we have swimmers who come from all over the world. We liaise with the teachers, with the parents. There's so much going on. And that's difficult. It was very, very difficult because everybody's got their own ideas, and so it's trying to allow the coaches and the staff to express themselves, while at the same time, you know, aiming for the same goal. I had a mentor when I was on the UK coaching program, Jenny Cody, and she helped me a lot with that. I said to her, look, I'm having a lot of issues with staff management, and some of it is their fault, some of it is my fault, so how can you help me with that? So we did a lot of work on it. Quite a few staff left, and we've recruited some really good, you know, coaches now. So we've got a very, very strong team. And what we do is, I'm not very hands-on anymore. I say to them, so we meet twice a week, Monday, Thursday for an hour and a half. Monday tends to be a bit more admin, but Thursday we do more informal CPDs. And I do not lead those CPDs. They decide in advance what they're going to talk about. They're in charge of their own topic. And I come as a normal coach. And I tend to not talk a lot. I try to let them talk. And you know, it's only at the end that I give my opinion. And quite often I won't, just because I'm quite happy with what's going on. And so I just let them, unless they ask me, but otherwise I'm quite chill. And so the coaches, you know, they're in charge of the squad. They have duties, responsibilities. I'm not going to be on their back all the time. My office is always open if they want some help, but, you know, they take responsibility, the good and the bad. So when they have parents who complain, I let them deal with that. That's not for me. So I think, you know, I think it works really well if you have the right staff. And I think we do now, so that's great. From a pool deck perspective, we try and have the coaches to work together so that the coaches below learn from the one above. Not just like the coach himself or herself, but also who are the swimmers in the group above? What do they do? How do they do it? That's quite important. So we try to mix. So there's as often as we can, there will be a lead coach and assistant coach. It's not always true, not every session, but we do that quite a lot. And I think, you know, again, it works really well. And what we do quite often as well is we talk about what do we want to achieve? What do we want to be seen as a club and as a staff? What do we want to represent? What are our values? What's our philosophy? And we did something like that a couple of weeks ago, I think, or maybe last week, just because we've got two new staff who joined in the middle of COVID. So I wanted to sort of go back to the basics and but just because the new coaches arrived doesn't mean that they didn't have an input. So we kind of discussed all the values we had and where we wanted to go, what we believed in, and not just from a streaming perspective. Again, those values are very important to us. We want to make sure they're important to our streamers. And so we try to have a common language, I guess. But at the same time, allowing once again the coaches and the streamers to express themselves. So what I mean by that is every coach of Plymouth Leander, Plymouth College, understands how important underwater work, technique, commitment to distance and speed, how important that is. We all understand that. And we're all going to use some drills. But as long as they teach it, I don't mind what drill they use, for example. So if a coach comes up with a different process to teach that particular skill and it works, then I'm happy with it. So common language with enough room to express ourselves as a coach and a person. And within that, obviously, let the streamers express themselves as well. Because not everybody's got the same body shape or the same commitment, and so it's important to allow that that synergy to happen between the concept and the people around it.
I think that leads nicely into the next little question that I wanted to talk about. So I don't know if you've done that one on purpose or if it's just luck. I had a look through kind of your profile on the Plymouth Leander website, and there's a little quote in there from you that says, you know, fast and skillful swimming is hard to come by. Is this because it's difficult to make a swimmer fast and skillful, in your opinion, or do you think it's, you know, not many people are both?
First things first, I would say that PE at school, and I'll say the home PE education, is not what it used to be. So call me old school, but in my days, we used to play with my brother in the garden, 4 hours, jump, land, crouch, play football, play basketball. I think nowadays with technology, iPads, iPhones, and so on, the kids spend probably, I'd say, a little bit too much time on their screen and not enough going outside and naturally becoming an all-rounded athlete. Okay, I don't know too much what the PE education is in the UK, to be honest with you, but I just think that the swimmers, when they join a swimming club, and after a few years, I don't think they're all as rounded athletes as they should be, respective to their age. If I'm not sure that makes sense, what I'm trying to say, but
no, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and you see that, for example, if you have a swimmer, a young swimmer, so say maybe, I don't know, 8 years old, and it happened to me a few times in the past, where I would look at that swimmer, and I'm like, that swimmer has a better perception, self-understanding of how their bodies work, whether it's in the water or on land. And then you start asking questions, do you do swimming only? Is there anything else? No, I do gym. Oh, you do gym. Okay, yeah, I joined a gymnastic club about 4 or 5 years ago. And then all of a sudden, that swimmer's got flexibility, range, awareness, and it transfers in the water. No doubt. I'm not saying that, you know, every swimmer should be gymnastic to be, you know, the next Adam Peaty, but I think at a young age, there's something missing. A simple thing like, if I throw a pool boy at a swimmer, they can't even catch up with
catch it, yeah.
And these kids are 16 years old plus. I don't think that's right. So I think that's part of it, but it's not all of it. I think what I mean by that was the package to sort of make it the elite, it's very, you know, big. It's quite diverse as well, you know. There are some common traits with swimmers who do really well at top level, but it doesn't mean they're all the same. And if you work with age players, you can spend years working on their technique, and the technique looks good, but how do you balance that with the development of the aerobic capacity, the kicking, the pulling, the sculling, and so on? And also the other thing is, a swimmer with good technique and good skills could grow a lot very quickly. And then the technique changes. Mm. So I'm not saying you've got to do it all over again, but it's another piece of the puzzle that you've got to try and find and develop. So I think that's what I mean by that. It's very hard. It's very difficult because it takes a long time to develop. Sometimes the swimmers will get stuck. You know, we all know swimmers who do really well at a young age, and then they can't make it any further, and so they quit. And it's difficult to find a way around that, because the mistake I made when I started actually at pool was spending a little bit too much time on technique. And I remember Graham Bassi said to me, you know, don't forget that these kids need to be fit and faster, right? And I was like, well, that's a good point. You know, you know it, but it's good to be reminded of it. So I went back and started, you know, doing a little bit more volume here and there. The balancing the two is very, very challenging. Very challenging. And I'm not even talking about the transition from age group to youth, because everybody knows about that, but there's another part of the transition that maybe we don't talk about enough, is transitioning from an international junior to an international senior, because that is another big obstacle to their career. Because, you know, you do well at European juniors, potentially world juniors, and then the next year, you're with the big guys, but you don't necessarily have the experience, the knowledge, the confidence, and the ability to progress further. And so how do we equip the swimmers with such things? And that takes a long time. That's the other problem. That's the other problem. It can take a long time, you know. And so, yeah, I guess it's a long answer, but that's sort of what I meant. Fast and good technique, it's not easy to find because it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of resilience from the swimmer and the coach. I think it takes a great relationship between the coach and the swimmer. And quite often the coach, you know, potentially will leave the club before that happens, or the swimmers will do something else. So, and that's why.
I think just from my experience working with age group swimmers, a lot of the time you either get someone who's really technical, really skillful, or someone that is really, really fast. Mm. So having that, like you say, that balancing act, that blend between the two, is, like you say, sometimes difficult to come across and difficult to develop, because it is like really walking on a tightrope, I guess.
Very much so. And it includes soft skills as well. I'm not a huge fan of that term, by the way, soft skills, because I just think the kids are soft enough as it is. but I think... I think a lot of swimmers don't quite understand that, you know, that they just see, all right, I've got a race to do, I'm going to try and go as fast as possible. And you might discuss the racing process before, an age group or not, quite often it goes out the window. So, you know, having the intelligence to stick to a plan, a program, what decision are you going to make if you can see your turn is not going to be perfect because you're not quite, the timing is not quite there because you're a little bit too close or a little bit too far. What decision are you going to make in such a small period of time? And quite often we coaches will say to the swimmer, that turn wasn't good or this and that. And I make that mistake, but I try hard to think in a different way and say, right, that swimmer repeatedly misses their turn. Let's pretend for a second that it's not their fault. Could it be my fault? Is it that I don't do enough turns, or is it that we don't pay enough attention to turns? What is it? And quite often, you know, if you're honest with yourself, you realize that there's something you could do different or better. You know, and sometimes the swimmers could do something different and better, right? But it's a coach athlete relationship. It's not a me or a you. It's we. It's us. How do we do that together? And so there's a lot more to it. There's a lot more to it than just swimming up and down. The race strategy is managing from, you know, how do you manage your effort from heat to semis to final? How do you manage that if you're top three in the world? It will be different to, you know, how are you going to manage it if you're 20th in the world? You know, and I do think some of these concepts are probably a little bit too advanced for, I guess, some youth swimmers and age groupers, but once in a while, just discussing this thing is quite important, especially, you know, British swimming and swimming learning, a lot of work with the coaches and the swimmers talking about emotion management, staying in the middle, avoiding the highs and the lows. And it's definitely something edge entrepreneurs need to work on. We all know that. But how do we do it? You know, it can't just be managing that at a competition while it's happening. And so it's taking the time to perhaps, you know, organizing team meetings, you know, and talk about such things. Or better, ask questions to the streamers, open questions that cannot be answered by yes or no. Ask them the questions and let them talk. And maybe write a few notes on a whiteboard. When we, maybe not so much this season because it's been a little bit crazy with COVID lockdowns and so on, but normally we would do 3 meetings per cycle. So one at the beginning, one in the middle, and one at the end. And we try to do that for every cycle, and sometimes we do a few informal meetings in between. My streamers also know they can, you know, come in my office or so. You know, it's important to do these things because, again, everybody's so busy. You know, the streamers get up early in the morning, they do their activation, they swim, they stretch, and then they go to rush to the minibus, go to school, have breakfast, and start their lessons. The uni guys have to go to uni, and I have to go to the office. So, you know, Monday to Friday, it's really hard to find the time to have those meetings with streamers who are not, I would say, professional streamers who are on funding, and you know, so. But it doesn't mean that it shouldn't be done. You've got to do it. I like to explain to them, you know, we've got that many weeks. This is what we're going to do in those weeks. This is why. You know, quite often when we do sets, I like to explain as well. I want them to understand the purpose of the set. And sometimes we'll lose. I say lose or waste. It's not right to say that, but we will spend 5-10 minutes talking about the set and why, what I expect and what I want to see. And we did it this morning, you know, a designer set where we had a bit of kicking, a bit of back and speed, and I said, you know, bring awareness to your kick on that last 50 and so on. I think the whys are important, and I think that applies to every streamer, age group to senior. I think it's important they understand why they're doing it, so they buy into it. And if they disagree, they can voice it and we can discuss it. Maybe not on poolside during the session, but after or before. And I think it's quite important. And I think that the final bit I'd say as well is, and I said that to them quite often, I'm not going to pretend that I know you better than you know yourself. So if the training cycle says X, Y, and Z, and you're really tired, so we are assuming that streamer that tendency is very high. There's, you know, 99% of the things right. I'm talking streamers who are committed. Okay.
Yeah.
If the way they feel physically, physiologically, is not quite where it should be, I want them to tell me, because if it's going to be a challenging set and their body or their mind or both are not ready for it, then we need to change the plan.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to get what I want out of it. So I wouldn't want to do that too often. But again, assuming this, the streamer is professional and committed, I've got no issues changing the plan in there. And I think it's important that they know that, because it strengthens your relationship with them. And their trust as well. Okay. Because I want to support them. I want to help them. So I don't want to pretend that I know them better. Tell me how you feel. Tell me what's going on. Tell me what you don't like about my coaching, about my session. We can have a conversation about it. All right? And I'll probably tell you what I don't like, you know, about you as a streamer. But it's, you know, and sometimes they are very difficult conversations to have. But that's also how you... I think you develop a great working relationship, you know, and loyalty, I guess, and efficiency. You know, some streamers, I've been coaching them 7.5 years. And there's one in particular, and you know, 7.5 years is a long time.
Yeah, really long sure. Time.
Others 4 or 5 years, and others 6 months.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a wide scope, and but I think it's really interesting. The journey, this relationship between the coach and the athlete is so amazing. It's, you know, it's definitely what, you know, drives me to coach every day. I'm not going to pretend I turn up on Poulsen and I'm, you know, everything is perfect every day. We have very good days, very bad days, and anything in between, right? We're a normal program. But you know, yeah, I love coaching. I love supporting these young kids and see what young people and see them achieve their potential, whatever that means.
Brilliant. So we're coming towards the end of the episode, Robin. I always ask our guests for kind of three tips on a specific topic. And, you know, you just spoke there at length about developing kind of fit, fast and skillful swimmers all in one, kind of intelligent races as well. So what would be out of kind of that whole answer, what would be your top three tips for developing fast and skillful swimmers?
Well, the first one I would say, are you working on the cause or the consequence? What I mean by that is the problem you see in front of you what needs to be fixed? Or is it happening because of something else? And I apply that to technique, skills, but also, you know, the periodization. So if all my swimmers turn up at the British Champs and they cannot finish their 200, so out of 10 swimmers, 9 or 10 of them or 8 of them cannot finish, clearly die on the last 50, that's clearly on me.
Yeah.
So the fact that they can't finish their race is, in my opinion, the consequence. It's not the problem itself. So if I work on the consequence, I'm potentially going to miss something. So what's causing that consequence? Where is the cause? Okay, and then you go back to technique is the same. You know, you can tell some swimmers to kick better butterfly, maybe using their legs more or something. But if they're not using their hips, if they're not using their chest, there's only so much they can kick from the knees. Okay,
yeah.
So is that the cause or the consequence? Okay. The second tip I have really is just to be patient. I heard Bob Bowman years ago say, I think the question was, you know, what does it take to develop someone like, I guess, Michael Phelps? But and he said something like, you know, it takes X, Y, and Z. But more importantly, he said, it takes time and patience. And that's what nobody understands. And you know, I understand that, but I think I do. And then I come across a situation where I get frustrated.
Yeah.
And then in that particular moment, I forgot that it takes time and patience. So I always go back to this thing that, you know, I heard him say in an interview, time and patience, time and patience. And then the last one is one of, I discuss with the coaches a lot, is positive reinforcement. And again, I'm not perfect with it. I do my best, but sometimes I don't do it the way I should. So you've got two ways to say to someone that they're underwater is not good. You can say, you know, your underwater wasn't good, technique, distance, not good. Or you can say, look, it's not bad. It's not bad at all. Let's see if we can do even better. The same message. The one is more positive than the other.
Yeah.
And I try to encourage the coaches to be more positive when they coach their swimmers. And I try and stick to that as well. And again, I'm not perfect on this, but I think it's really important, because otherwise it gets frustrating for you. It gets frustrating for the swimmer. And the entire, the whole experience is not, well, it's quite negative. So I think if you get to the point where positive reinforcement is not going to work, you might as well walk away from that swimmer and see someone else. And if we can find the things they're not good at, we can also surely find the things they're really good at and maybe praise them. Because if they're good at it, can they be great at it? And if they're not good at it, they know it, they're not stupid. So let's just say, hey, you know what? It's getting better. Let's see how we can improve it even more. And again, it's definitely not the same message. And what I find when I do that is that the swimmers make more eye contact. Their body language, their face, everything is a little bit more open to communication, and they're more receptive, and therefore they push off the wall, and I don't know if they have a smile on their face, but oh, actually, he said my underwater was a bit better, and I wasn't really paying attention to it, so I'm going to pay even more attention to it. Again, it's not going to be fixed overnight, it's time and patience, but yeah, these are the three tips: cause or consequence, time and patience, and a positive reinforcement.
Perfect. That's well, certainly for me, you know, I can agree with all three of those things, and you know, I think they're really kind of simple things to think about as well in terms of going back to basics. Let's think about what's the root cause of a problem. Let's be patient with it. And let's frame things a little bit more positively. I think that's certainly something I'm going to take away and apply into my practice. So thank you for that, Robin.
No problem. Thank you for having me and thank you for your time.
Okay, so that brings us to the end of episode 6 of series 4 of the Poolside Pass podcast. Great to hear from Robin Armayan about his experience coaching out in France, in Australia, and then making his move over to the UK. Really, really fascinating to hear him talk about cause and consequence when you're speaking about evaluating a swimmer's performance or evaluating a swimmer's technique. That's a really good key point for coaches to keep in mind. But also that balancing act when you're working with age group swimmers about making them fit and fast and making them really technical. Where do you fall on that balancing act? If you like the podcast, make sure you give us some great feedback on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at the Poolside Pass. You can catch all of our episodes over at your favourite podcast platform, but also on our website, www.thepoolsidepass.com. Until next time, take care.